Job chapter 1 and verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the east. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and all around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys feeding beside them, when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped, and he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he'll give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a pot's herd with which to scrape himself, and he sat in the midst of the ashes. And his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept God, accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Well, it all happened so suddenly. How suddenly disaster can overtake us. How suddenly calamity overwhelmed this man Job. And yet we're given this ideal picture, aren't we, in the opening five verses of the book. We are given a description of his character. We're told he is blameless and upright. He's wholehearted and straight. He fears God and he turns away from evil. We're given a summary of his wealth there in verse 3. He has 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, a large household. He was a wealthy man, wealthier than anyone else in the East. Given a picture of his family there in verse 4. And it's a happy family. There are no strained, awkward relationships, no broken relationships there. The sons and daughters of Job delight to feast together. They enjoy each other's company. It's a happy family. And there's a sample also of Job's godliness, because while they are in the course of their festivities together, Job sacrifices on their behalf and intercedes before God for them, because Job is concerned not that they may bring shame upon him and his reputation, but he says there in verse 5, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. He cares about the heart religion of his children, and on that account he intercedes for his children and sacrifices for them. So an ideal man and an ideal life is pictured for us in those opening few verses of chapter 1, and then, as you recall, one by one the messengers come, and in verse 13 and following, in that striking style that is intended and deliberate, it's intended to impress upon us how suddenly and how totally this disaster sweeps over his life and overwhelms Job. His whole life falls to pieces in a matter of moments. His livestock, his wealth is taken from him, his servants are struck down, his property is destroyed, his children, his family, the lives of his 10 children are taken away by that great storm. As if that isn't enough, then we're told in chapter 2 and verse 7, his own physical health is taken away from him, and Job's wife gives him counsel. And what she says in effect is, Job, God has so clearly, so soundly renounced you, you might as well renounce him. It's that man that God describes as blameless, wholehearted. A man given in wholehearted devotion and commitment to God. But it's tough to be blameless when God smashes your life to smithereens. So we're going to look at this blameless man, and we're going to look at his trial. Notice first of all the approval that's given. The approval of the blameless man. It's there in verse 1 of chapter 1 and verse 8 and chapter 2 and verse 3. And notice that it's not just the writer of the story who tells us that Job is blameless and upright and so on, but the Lord himself describes Job in that way in verse 8 of chapter 1 and verse 3 of chapter 2. It is the Lord who says of Job, there is no one like him on the face of the earth. So he is the premier, we might say, servant of the Lord, wholehearted, straight, fearing God, turning from evil. You know, if you've got the Authorized Version there, it uses the word perfect, which is fine, but the problem with that word perfect in our culture is it carries this sort of overtone, doesn't it, of being without sin. And that's not what the word is intended to convey to us. It's a word that means whole, wholeness, complete. He's a complete servant of the Lord. He's all that a servant of God should be. That's what it's conveying to us. He's wholehearted in his devotion of the Lord. He's upright, and the word means straight. he fears God, he turns away from evil. God says that about his servant Job. The approval of a wholehearted man. God is delighted with him. So as God looks upon his servant Job, he's pleased with him. That doesn't mean that there was nowhere in his life where he couldn't grow more in godliness, where he couldn't develop as a servant of God and become even more useful as a servant of God. It doesn't mean that Job could no longer make any progress in his spiritual life and in spiritual things. But as God looked upon his servant Job at that time, what he was saying is, where my servant Job is right now, what he is at this moment in terms of consecration and devotion to me, what Job is right now in his circumstances, that pleases me. It's not that Job can't go on any further in consecration or devotion, but at that moment, all that Job was pleased the Lord. And yet, this servant suffers. And that tells us really something that I know, you already know, but that we need occasionally to have underlined and reinforced for us in our thinking, which is that God may be delighted with you, and yet you may suffer intensely. God may be delighted with you, and yet you may suffer intensely. Now you might say, well, I already know that, and I've read this story of Job before, and I know that you know this. But the trouble is that we find so often that when we are in trouble, and when we have been cast into a pit of distress, we don't see things as clearly as we did previously. When we are plunged into the pit of distress, the message that we once got loud and clear seems to get garbled. And what we previously said we knew and that we were sure about, we find we've forgotten. When we're in distress, it's common for us to respond to the situation not logically but psychologically. It makes us think and feel in a certain way, and we get mixed up. And though we know that a person can be completely pleasing to God and yet find themselves plunged into a pit of distress and despair, we find that when we are thrown into that pit, it's all too common for us to find ourselves saying, God must be angry with me. God must be displeased with me. There must be something in my life abhorrent to God. And we seem to forget the things that we said that we once knew. And we search our souls, and we find that our conscience doesn't convict us of a particular sin that might be the cause of divine chastisement of us. It may be that we lay the matter before the Lord and we ask him to show us sins that perhaps are unknown to us, that we can seek to confess those sins, and yet even though our conscience doesn't accuse us of sin, and we are, as far as we know, not under divine chastisement, we find that this continual thought rises in our hearts and mind that we have somehow offended God, he's angry with us, and this is a judgment from God. Even though we know that God can be delighted with us and we suffer, that thought goes out of our minds. We persist with this idea that God abhors us, that he wouldn't have allowed this to happen if he loved us and if we were pleasing to him. Sometimes it's difficult, in other words, for our faith to keep pace with what in our better moments we know. So we need to remember this man Job, and we need to remember his circumstances. Remember God's approval of this wholeheartedly devoted man, and the fact that he suffered intensely without that being in any way at all a sign of God's displeasure towards him. Perhaps someone here this morning needs to hear that again and remember that again. Then the second thing to notice here is the ignorance of this devoted man. The ignorance of this devoted man. It comes through in chapter 1 verses 6 through to 12 and chapter 2 verses 1 to 7. And I want you just to put yourself in Job's shoes, or in his sandals we might say, for a moment. And think about the story from Job's perspective. perspective. Imagine yourself having just finished sacrificing for your children and interceding for your family before God. And the very next thing you hear is that the Sabaeans have invaded your territory, slaughtered your servants and carried away all your oxen and your donkeys. And then the very next thing that happens is that there's a series of messengers coming, hot on the heels, one after the other, and they're telling you that all your wealth is lost, all your family is wiped out. And your response is to worship. As we read there in verse 20, the end of the verse, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And what happens next? Putrefying, loathsome boils break out all over your body, from your head to your foot, and your physical health is destroyed. That's how it was for Job. And Job doesn't have the knowledge that you and I have. He's ignorant. And it's not an ignorance that he can be blamed for, it's just that he doesn't know. What we are told about in verses 6 to 12 of chapter 1, Job knows nothing about that. What we hear in chapter 2 and verses 1 to 7, Job hasn't got a clue that any of that has happened. All that was hidden from him. He was ignorant of all that. We know what has happened behind the scenes, as it were. All Job has got is the scenes. So it all looks very different for this man Job. And he doesn't know then any of this that has taken place between the Lord and Satan, the accuser. He doesn't hear the accuser ridiculing Job and his fidelity to the Lord, as if it was something the Lord had bought. And he doesn't hear the Lord steadfastly defending his honor and his integrity. Job is ignorant of all that that goes beyond behind the scenes that we know about. He doesn't see it, he doesn't hear about it, none of it is reported to him. So we've got, as it were, the reader's edge. We can see behind the scenes. Job sees none of it. And that gives rise, doesn't it, to another inference that we can make from this passage, and it's this, that frequently, we don't have nearly enough information to form a correct estimate of our sufferings. We don't have nearly enough information to make a correct estimate of our sufferings. Do you realize the extent of your ignorance? Do you realize how limited your knowledge of things is? There is an ignorance for which we might say we are blameworthy. There are things, aren't there, that are so clearly reported and taught in Scripture that if we remain ignorant of that, well then, we are blameworthy for our ignorance. We should know it. There's no reason for us not to know certain things. And you could say, if you don't know it, that's your own fault. But there are many matters concerning which, in this life, we are always ignorant. We will never know. That's the fact of living in this world. There is much that you and I just do not know and will not know so long as we're in this world. Back in 1940, there was a man from Spain came to London on a cultural exchange. Arrangements had been made for him to visit Britain and to travel around to observe the activities of the Boy Scout movement in Britain. The aim was, ostensibly, to develop the Boy Scout movement in Spain. British intelligence knew why he was really in the country. They knew that he was working for the German intelligence, military intelligence, and he had come to spy and to send reports back to Berlin. And so they put on a show for him. There was very little military hardware in the country in 1940, hardly any kind of significant weaponry in Britain at all. And so what they did was they sent him on a certain route around these various scouts organizations and made sure that he would pass army camps full of tanks, full of all kinds of weapons and soldiers. And then they flew him to Scotland. And as he was going to Scotland, squadron after squadron of Spitfires were flying past his plane in all sorts of directions. What he didn't know is that there was only one squadron of Spitfires. And they were flying all the way to Scotland, turning round, flying back over him, different altitudes, different directions. He sent back a report, Britain is an armed camp.
They got weapons everywhere. What he didn't know was far more important than what he knew. What he didn't see was more important than what he did see. And it's so often like that for us as believers. When we are beset with troubles, when we are in the midst of sufferings and trials, we have no way of knowing what is behind the scenes. And we need to meditate then on that passage that we read earlier in Ephesians 6, and particularly verse 12, which tells us that we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness. We don't know how much we're being watched. We don't know how much is being done, as it were, off stage, that we have no part in. We just don't know how crucial it might be for us to continue to walk in faithfulness. That may be far more crucial than you might suppose at any time in your life. We just don't have nearly enough information. Frequently, often, we don't have enough information to form a correct estimate of our troubles and of our sufferings. Now, how does that help us? Well, knowing that might just keep us from exasperation and from being overly discouraged in the midst of our troubles. And then thirdly, you can see here the accusation of the blameless man. The accusation of the blameless man, verse 9 to 10 of chapter 1 and verses 4 and 5 of chapter 2. We'll just look at verses 9 to 10 of chapter 1. If you want to know what the book of Job is about, then you need to listen to the devil. Because it is the devil who poses the central issue. And you see it in verse 9. The central issue of the book of Job is not the question, why does the righteous suffer? Notice I said the righteous. I didn't say the innocent, because there's a sense in which no one is innocent before God. But the righteous, according to Psalm 32, are those who are God's forgiven people. But it's often suggested that the main theme and the central theme of the book of Job is, why do the righteous suffer? And of course, the book of Job does touch on that question, but that's not the real issue. That's not the core issue upon which this book is based. The central issue in the book of Job is the matter that the accuser raises in chapter 1 and verse 9, when he says, does Job fear God for nothing? And you can see what he's suggesting. He says, you've hedged him about. Just add up all the things that you've given to this man in terms of finance and prosperity and security and family. Add it all up. Of course this man is going to be faithful to you. Of course he'll serve you. Look at what you give him. The reason why Job is the way he is, the reason why he loves you and fears you and serves you, is because you bought him off. You paid him well for his devotion. Of course he'll serve you. And what the accuser is saying then is that the only reason why a man or a woman would serve God is because of what they get out of it, what they receive for it, that their service is motivated by some kind of political or economic consideration. Just recently, in the past few weeks, there's been this storm in the newspapers, hasn't there, about one of the unions, the largest donor of the Labour Party, allegedly trying to rig an election. And the leader of the party has intervened, and some people have got very upset about that, because that's just not how things are supposed to go. A lot of money has changed hands, and now there's got to be some kind of payback for that. When I say that, of course, I've got no political motive in saying that. I'm not picking on Labour as if they're the only ones. This is how the world of politics operates. This is how it works. Someone scratches your back, well then, you expect a similar favour as soon as you've got an itch. And here's Satan saying that Job's commitment to God is political, it's economic. In essence, the issue that the accuser raises is this: will a man serve God, if need be, for nothing? Will he serve God for nothing? Will a woman serve God? Will she love God? Will she worship God out of sheer disinterested love for God? If everything is stripped away from this man Job, he will curse you to your face, he says. No one would serve you unless you bought them off. No one would serve you without a bribe. So the issue here is the issue of discipleship. Will a man serve God for nothing? Will a man serve God when there's no reward for doing so? No payoff, no profit. Will a man serve God? Will he love God? Will he worship God just because he loved God? Just because he was his God? Would a man do that? We're told that in the early days of the colonies in New England, that when a man presented for Christian ministry and was examined before his ordination, one of the questions that would sometimes be put to these men was this: are you willing to be damned for the glory of God? Are you willing to be damned for the glory of God? Now you might hear that and say, well, that's a false question. That makes no sense. A man doesn't have to be damned for the glory of God. He can be saved for the glory of God. So it's a false question. Well, I think they were sensible enough people to know that themselves. But what they were driving at is this: does the glory of God and the praise and the honour of God mean more to you than a mere cliche? Is it more than just words? Does it really matter to you? And if it was conceivable that for God's glory and praise, that would be advanced if you were damned, would you be willing to be damned? Does it mean that much to you that God should be glorified? Now that's a very, very searching question, isn't it? And we must keep in mind, of course, that in one sense it is a false question. But it is a question that helps us cut through so much of the clutter in our lives as Christians. We have to face the accuser's question. In one sense, I know it's an unanswerable question for us, but we must ask it of ourselves anyway. We need to ask ourselves, would I serve God for nothing? Would I serve him for his own sake, for his own glory? Am I prepared just for that, as if nothing was coming back in return? Would I love God even if it seemed I got nothing out of it? Would I adore God if it seemed he cast me down? Would I cling to him if he seemed every time to turn away? Do I merely serve God and love God merely for who he is? Or do I love the gifts more than I love him? Would I rather use God than love God? And you can say, well, those are still false questions. But are they? Or are they searching questions? And then lastly, we see the response of the blameless man. How does Job respond? We'll just look at chapter 1 and verse 20 and 21, where Job says, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And as you read that, you might be tempted to think, oh, Job, I wish I could somehow come back across the centuries and speak with you to help you see how these things have really worked out. If only you knew what was really going on in your situation. You're saying the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away, but no, you see, I know what's gone on behind the scenes. I know the devil's part in all this. If only you knew that. It's all down to Satan. The Lord's just merely permitted this to happen. It's not that the Lord has taken away. He's permitted Satan to take it away. Well, I think if it were possible for us to go back through time like that and speak to Job in that way, he would just turn and look at you with the most puzzled look on his face. He'd probably say, and what difference does that make? You see, you might think that it helps to say, that the Lord didn't do it directly. He permitted it to take place. But Job knows, and you should know if you would think about it, that if God really is sovereign, if he really is God, if he really is in control of anything and everything, then he has to decide to permit as well. So there's no way of getting out of this. There's no way of avoiding the rough cutting edge of this. If God is sovereign, if God is always in control, then we've still got to face this problem. We tend to think, you see, don't we, that it's unbelievers who have a problem with suffering. But really it's people, believing people, people who believe in a sovereign God, the God of the Bible, it's they who have the problem with suffering. It's the person who believes in a truly sovereign God who, as the confession says, foreordains whatsoever comes to pass, and who tells us that he is committed to the good of his people. It's those people who've got a problem when it comes to the sufferings of God's people. Some religious people, you see, they're completely unperturbed by sufferings. They might be sorry that other people suffer, but they haven't got a problem with the fact that other people suffer. A polytheist has got no problem, has he? Because to him, there's one God who might do me good, but there's a whole host of other gods and goddesses who might come along and just mess it all up for me. The fatalist says, whatever will be, it's the way the cookie crumbles, and I might not like some of the crumbs, but that's just the way it goes. The dualist, that's the person who thinks that there are these principles and good and evil always in conflict in the universe, and they must believe then that if they're always in conflict and they're equally balanced, that evil's got to win at least 50% of the time. So you have to expect suffering. A materialist believes that everything operates by blind chance. Things just happen. And so you shouldn't expect suffering to make sense. It's just a matter of chance. It's believers in the God of the Bible who've got a problem. Because the God of the Bible is a sovereign God who rules everything and who says that he works out all things for the good of his people. So it seems that something has to be wrong when you see God's people suffer, very often in the way that they do. But you see how big God is in Job's eyes? He doesn't try to cut God down to size. He says, the Lord has given, and the Lord has taken away. But notice his response. And we sometimes overlook this. Job weeps. Job weeps. Look at verse 20. Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell on the ground. Those are signs of grief. Those are signs of mourning, distress. He grieves. This man, Job, was not a slab of stone. He's a man made in the image of God, and he weeps and he grieves at his distress. Blameless, wholeheartedly devoted people know what it is to grieve and mourn and weep over their losses. But he doesn't only weep. There at the end of that verse we're told he worshipped. You see that in verse 21. He says, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And when he said that, he put a pin right through the devil's balloon. How could Job say that in the light of all he'd been through? Well, surely it must be by grace alone. Notice the wording, the Lord has given. In other words, Job was convinced of God's grace, that everything he was and that everything he had was God's gift to him. If everything I have is a gift of God's grace, then it must mean I have no real or abiding claim on it. And if God should take it away, then he's only taken what is his anyway. If I really believe in the grace of God, then this ought to be my response. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. We're told of the covenanter, Alan Cameron, that he was languishing in prison in Edinburgh, and he had failed to pay an unjust fine that was placed upon him because of his religious convictions. He didn't know that his son, Richard, had been killed. One cruel man hacked off the head of his son and his hands and went to the prison, opened the door, threw them down the stairs into the dungeon. And he shouted, "Do you know who these are?" Dallan Cameron picked up the head and the hands and he put them on his lap. He tenderly felt them. He said, "They're my sons, my dear sons. Good is the Lord, who could never wrong me or mine, but has made goodness and mercy to follow me all the days of my life." So what am I saying then when I refer to Job's words here? I'm not saying I'm trying to make you a hero or a heroine in the work of God. I'm not saying this is a text you must always recite whenever you find yourself in trouble. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that as God's people, in the midst of troubles and sufferings, we are free to weep and we are to be faithful to worship the God whose name must be blessed.